This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Eventually, one day, we thought, we figured out how to live with the bull ants. Just reroute them.
But I'm figuring, just get him to Chinatown. Get rid of him.
I was at the end of this marriage. I was in therapy. I was really stressed out.
You know, there's no accidents. There are absolutely no accidents, and I've really come to believe that over the time.
Eventually, one day, the trees around us are looking kind of like they're alive. Got close to them, and they were full of bull ants with wings. And I thought, oh, God, we're in hell. We're in hell now.
They were all speaking this language.
Well, of course, I was coming back in 1970. And, you know, these were wild times in our culture.
But when they're flying and they're swarming, they don't bother you. They never bothered us.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California, where only the gophers and the real estate developers swarm, this is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller with stories about meaningful journeys. And you had a meaningful journey.
Yes, very quickly. The moral of this meaningful journey is lost on me now, but I flew to Fargo, North Dakota in January. Don't ask why. Business, I made $100. So I had to take the midnight red-eye to get there in time. So Elizabeth checks the bus to the airport, leaves at 9 p.m., drives me over 7 miles. No bus. They've canceled the bus. So she drives me to San Francisco, an hour and a half. We pull up. I hop out of the car. Love you. Bye. She drives off, and I've left my shoulder bag in the car. No money, no credit cards, no ID. I do not exist. My mittens? I've got my mittens, but no jacket. And the airline clerk is very kind. I exhibit distress. She switches me to the 6 a.m. flight, no extra charge. And we have an 800 number, so I leave a message for Elizabeth that when she gets home in an hour and a half, she can turn around and drive an hour and a half to get me my stuff, after which she can drive an hour and a half back home. Mm. And she does, and she is very kind.
Love you.
And I sack out in an airport seat designed for punishment. And at last, at 2 p.m., arrive in Fargo, North Dakota, where it's below zero, but the people were nice, and I came home with gratitude in my heart. And that is the meaning of that.
And now for our story. We met Jackie Godden at a friend's party, a very quiet, friendly woman with a tall, gangly husband who plays the upright string bass beautifully. It was one of those conversations where you discover that the gold is in the quiet streams. We decided to devote the whole program to Jackie's several worlds.
When I talked with Jackie Godden, I sort of felt that she'd lived in three places in her life: Mississippi, Australia, and everywhere else. And she didn't talk much about what we're supposed to be talking about, the journeys between. In fact, we will violate that sacred journalistic credo of explaining everything and leave you to guess exactly what brought her from one world to another. She talked about the places and the living in them.
I lived in Greenwood, Mississippi, with my grandmother and my brother. I think my parents had had a rather stormy life together, so life with my grandparents was wonderfully unconditional love. It was in town. As I think about it, I had a neighbor down the road who was had been born in slavery. And we used to go over to her house, and she'd tell us stories about what it was like growing up as a girl in slavery. And she just had this beautiful way of telling stories. She'd go, child, and we didn't have nothing. And we'd go down into the holler at night, and we'd have our prayer meeting, you know, things like that. And I could hear, you know, all the cicadas and see the lightning bugs, and because it was hot and humid, you know, so hot and humid. And imagine what that was like. Liddy. Her name was Liddy. This was in the 50s, so she must have been a young girl herself. I used to travel by myself a lot when I was really young. Take the bus to Memphis and catch the train, which I love, traveling on the train. My earliest memory of traveling was when I was 6, and at that time, what my grandmother would do is tell the driver, you know, there would be notes and we'd have addresses pinned onto us as to exactly where we were going. And in those days, everybody would take care of you, you know. It was, oh, look at those children traveling by themselves. And it was such a big deal, you know, we felt like we were very grown up. And we knew we could ask anybody on the bus or on the train. The conductors, all the conductors in those days were black. In fact, I had an uncle, he had been a train conductor. And because black people were really big in the railroad. You know, my grandma would make the traditional fried chicken, potato salad, and cornbread, and, you know. And black people, we weren't allowed to go into the dining cars. So everybody had lots of food in there, and they were shared. So, you know, we were well looked after. And that's what it was like in those days. I mean, in the black community, I felt really safe in that community. I knew everybody. I felt really safe until Emmett Till was lynched and murdered there. And that shook me. It really shook me. Because it was the first time, as I told you, I roamed a lot. And I always felt that I could ask anybody for help and directions. But of course, my world was all black. And it was at that point that I realized that there were people who would hurt children. In Greenwood, somebody was babysitting me, and everybody stood up. We went down to the funeral home and saw the body, because his mother insisted that the world see what they'd done to her child. And I was being babysat by some teenagers. And so I ended up seeing his body. And it wasn't the first dead person that I'd ever seen, but certainly like that, it was just horrible. Just disfigured, smeared, his features were like a mask. And I was horrified. I mean, I didn't, you know, I was in line. There was such excitement and such electricity and energy around this. But the actual fact of it was a real horror. Yeah, that's a memory that I carry very strongly, that there are people that I can't trust. It was so irrational because it was just because I was black. That was really scary. And before that, I hadn't thought about people being black or white, really. But then it made me... It wasn't that I didn't ever see white people, but I didn't live amongst them. My grandmother was the first town librarian in the black community. I mean, she finished 8th grade, and she put all of her brothers through college. She had 3 brothers, and they all went to college. But she didn't, but she and her husband put them through college. Education was real important to her. And at some point, I don't know exactly why or what happened exactly, but they asked her, the principal of the school in the black community asked her if she wanted to help set up a library, which would be a public library. And she did. And, you know, we used to go down to the library, to the white library, and they'd give us all their discarded, broken books. And my grandmother would come home and construct covers and write the titles on the tapes of various colors. And that was the first time I ever heard of the Dewey Decimal System. And she set it up. And she did that for years. She just took all the discards and made them whole, put spines back on them. I learned to drive when I was 12 because there was no place for us to stop, to stay. We all traveled together. I was a navigator, and I'd read the maps. And I'd never thought about getting lost.
I'd read the maps, getting lost. There was no place for us getting lost,
I left Mississippi and moved to Yellow Springs, Ohio. I went to high school there, and I hung out there. That's where my teenage years were spent. My mother was teaching at a small college, and then she settled in Yellow Springs. She was looking for a place, you know, a home, and she went and liked that community, and we ended up living there. That was a really big culture shock, because I'd never been around white people. And I ended up being the only black girl in my class, as I remember. And I was the only black girl in my class for quite a few years. But one of the things that I noticed when I got into the school is that I think in that time there was Black History, now we have Black History Month. There was Black History Week or maybe it was even a day, you know. And there was no Black history. In fact, there was less Black history. And nobody knew anything about Blacks. And in the Black schools, during Black History Week month, you know, the month of February, even down in the South, it was like there were always role models and people, biographies, you know. It was a real source of pride. And when I got to Ohio, there was none of that. In fact, the only thing, pretty much all they said about Black people was they were slaves. An adolescent, if you're feeling awkward or at that time you feel like you stand out like a sore thumb, and it was not that Black people were invited culturally to, you know, it was not an inclusiveness other than to try to become more like white people. And so I ended up hanging out in the woods, and, you know, I went in a totally different way than I had grown up. I mean, when I was in the South, there was generally a great fear of snakes and things wild, you know, rattlesnakes and water moccasins. And, you know, it never occurred to me that a snake wasn't poisonous. And when I got to Yellow Springs, they had a glen, a beautiful glen. And I remember I was with my friend, and we rode our bikes over to the glen, and then I saw that it was a big wood, you know. And then she started walking down these steps, and there were something like 180 steps to walk down the woods. It was a long descent, you know, and I balked. I wasn't going to walk down those steps past all that bushes hanging over us. And she just said, well, come on, and then she left. And I remember, you know, when I finally got my courage up and I started to go down those steps, oh, it felt like my, you know, like these blinders came off of my eyes and my heart. And I just went, yes, 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 yes. And I loved the glen. So when things got tough for me, that's where I would go. And I spent a lot of time over the next few years when things got rough in the woods. And I saw a lot of things for the first time in that area. Like, it seems like that year was a year of a lot of firsts. I saw the Northern Lights and the great white snowy owl in the pine forest in the woods, just happened to be passing through. I love that place. It turns out that I traveled a bit. Maybe I
we just didn't get picked up because we were hitching. So there was not much of a moon. We lost the moon.
I woke up to find butterflies all over me. Married an Australian, went to Sydney, was pregnant with my first child. We worked in Sydney. We did theater work. Different theaters, singing, dancing. We did that for 4 years, had two kids, and then we moved to the bush and we homesteaded. We lived on top of a ridge between two rivers that we had to ford to get in and out. It's beautiful and it's wonderful, but you have to be really respectful of it because Australia is very venomous. They've got every manner of stinging, including stinging trees, you know. We found our place where we decided we wanted to build our home on top of this ridge that had this incredible outlook, you know. And as I said, our nearest neighbor was 5 miles away up the ridge, and we had a CB radio that we kept in contact with people who lived on the road because we had two very young children, so we had to make sure that we could get out if we had to. And when we moved there was no water up there, so we used to go down to the river. We would drive down. We had a 40-gallon drum of water. So that water, before it hit the ground again, we got a lot of use out of the water. It was very precious. You know, from the time you boiled it for drinking, well, a certain amount went for drinking, but any of the other water had to have multiple uses before it was finally poured onto plants. And we put a dam in, and everybody had rain tanks. Eventually, we were set up to catch water off of our roof. Water is the issue, living in the bush. And it was the best drinking water. When we first got there and we found our spot, it was about a mile down this ridge, so we had to put in a road, which, you know, we didn't want to disturb very much in the bush, so we mainly made our path through cutting down all the dead standing stuff and just pulling and dragging and cleared the path. So it was like this very windy, beautiful little road into the woods. The big thing was is that everything that we thought that we were going to do, mostly we couldn't do. And coming from the city, the biggest thing was to accept that we had to do the things that presented themselves. So we had to slow down and change our rhythm and learn to be okay and to breathe with it. For instance, you have to do the things that you need to do while the light is good. By the time the dark comes, you must know where everything is, because with kerosene light, and we had an old gas lamp, a beautiful light, and flashlights, but you don't want to use those, not as a way of life. I remember one night, Brian was in town, and the kids were sleeping, and they were under their mosquito netting. All of a sudden, I looked up, and there was this huge spider on the wall. I mean, really big spider. And my kids were safe, but I didn't want the spider there. I remember going over and just tapping on the wall, and the spider just sort of slithered back in between the panels. And all of a sudden, I realized, I can't believe I just did that. I was I didn't freak out or anything. I just figured that if he's in there, who knows how many there are in there. And I'm not here to make war on everything that I don't like. You just stay out of my region, I'll stay out of yours. Because the things that were so dangerous were so deadly that the things that normally annoy me or even frighten me, like the tarantulas, they have spiders in Australia that are as big as crabs. They're huge, amazing things. But they didn't bother me after a while, because there were things that were really dangerous, you know. One night, we had gotten chickens, and it rained very heavily that night, a big storm. And that Australia has been amazing storms on the East Coast, lots of thunder and lightning. And all of a sudden, we hear this just blood-curdling scream. It's awful. I mean, it's like nothing you want to get up for. We realized it was the chickens. And Brian got out a bit, and here he is just naked. He has to go out into the chicken coop and confront this tiger cat. Well, the tiger cat's a really strange-looking animal, unique to Australia. It has, like, the head of, like, a dog, short hair like a dog with spots almost, and the tail like a cat, and claws and teeth like a cat. And a good-sized little animal. He killed the tiger cat. And out of that, three chickens survived. And their combs turned white, and they were catatonic. I like wildness, in the woods anyway. But of course, we had to learn everything. Like, we moved into an area where there was a bull ant's nest. It wasn't until we got back with our kids that we realized that we had moved to where a bull ant's nest is. And the bull ants periodically would come in, and I remember, you know, one of those big ceramic cups, looking into it, and there was a big bull ant. This is the one that opened his nippers and, you know, raised his tail and looked at me, and I thought, oh, he filled the cup, and he was beautiful in a wicked kind of way. So what we found out was that once we got rid of that nest, one ant will come through. And if you kill it, then two will come. If you kill them, then you got four or more. And then all of a sudden you got a swarm looking for their dead. So this can't do this. Can't live this way. So I remember getting up and deciding to use a shovel and take them out of the territory. And then it was just a matter of an occasional bull ant will come through the territory, just give them another path. And then they were not a problem. So we were expecting other children to come. We bought a huge property. And there were other children, our children's age, a whole generation of children to come. And after 2 years, there were no other children. There were a lot of kangaroos and a lot of other critters to play with. But they needed the socialization of other children. I mean, they were gregarious, especially our oldest boy. Amber used to say, "Well, let's go get some company. We need some company now." So we decided that we would move into town or on the edge of town for them. You know, the only time I ever felt any strange, like I'd come up against a barrier with people, really came up against a barrier, was when I was with South Africans. I mean, because it, you know, I know racism in this country. I know having, you know, there's a thing about growing up and dealing with racism. You have to, one, be able to recognize it, and two, you have to be able, the other side is not to project it, right? You know, for anything that comes up. But I'd run up against this thing, and I didn't know what it was, this wall. It was usually with South Africans or African whites. And in the country towns, people didn't know what I was. So they knew I was not Aboriginal. People used to confuse me for Fijian or, you know, some other Melanesians. But I didn't experience the kind of racism that I have here. However, when my son started to go to school, that's when it began to come up, because they thought he was Aboriginal. And I wasn't happy about that. Well, one night in our little hut, we had a stove, but we had a wood stove, one end of the house, and a fireplace at the other. But we only cooked inside when it was raining or cold or something. So we mostly cooked outside in this open fire pit. Wonderful. I mean, I baked bread in the fire pit, everything. So one night after the boys were in bed and just kind of settling down before not wanting to go to sleep, it was a really dark night. And had turned out all the lights and was just sitting outside. Looked up in the sky, and all of a sudden this huge thunderhead, I mean huge, just lit up. And there was incredible lightning in this thunderhead. And of course, these huge billowing towers that were just changing shapes all the time. And all of these colors, incredible colors going through it. It would just light up, and then we would be in darkness and it would light up again, and it was incredible. And no sound, no thunder. And then periodically streaks of lightning would go out of the thunderhead into the sky. I've never seen anything like that before or since. And I could just as easily have missed it if I hadn't turned the lights out, if I'd gone to bed instead of coming out and looking at the dark. Yeah, it was really home in a way that I went back in 96, and I remember sitting in one spot, and life is so intense. I mean, when I went back there, I thought, this was my life. I mean, it was just so, the beauty of it, and the, you know, everybody who was there and had stayed on the land, and the people who had come, they had this strong strength of wiriness and kind of dry wiriness, but, you know. And I remember just sitting in one spot for most of a day just to watch the light change, just to see, just to be able to witness. And how did I, you know, me, this person, survive in this environment? And not only that, I felt like we thrived, you know. I mean, our whole family thrived in that environment. I remember, you know, sitting out and just looking down the paddock for the day and just watching the clouds, incredible clouds, formations that would happen. And all of a sudden, you know, there's a squawking in the trees, and it's the kookaburras and the magpies going after a nest. And just the light, just watching the light change from morning, the afternoon to the evening, and the stars. They're like three-dimensional crystals. So many. I really need green. I need to be close to wildness.
This is the first time now that I've lived in a town for 30 years. And that was really hard for me. And I had to make peace with it. But I need earth around me and under my feet. And I live in a place right now where there's a lot of concrete. And when I first moved there, I couldn't walk on the concrete. My feet, my ankles, my legs would ache. And I'd be walking down to the local park, and I'd be walking on people's lawns wherever I could. And eventually, I've begun to make peace with it, because now I'm just grateful to have a place that I can call home that I probably won't get kicked out of. So I've had to, especially in the last year, make peace with just being where I am and being grateful for having a home, because can't take it for granted. So maybe now home is just becoming more in terms of my innermost attitude. That's where home really is.
In Petaluma, California, we were talking with Jackie Godden.
So that's our trips for this week. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye, funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, California Arts Council, and you.
Visit our website, www.independenteye.org, where you can listen to past shows, buy things, support the show, tell us about your stories.
Next up, living among the Berbers in Morocco.
And a businessman climbs a volcano and meets the goddess Pele.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
My grandmother was kind of a maverick, but she had standing in the community. She took care of the people around her, you know. My grandmother cooked every Sunday. She'd cook a big meal. She'd make homemade ice cream sometimes and always dessert. And before we sat down to eat, I had to go and take this plate over to Mr. Henry and go and take this over to Miss Emma. They'd always make sure in her little community clubs that they took care of the people around them. And no desserts came to the table without slices missing, except birthday cake.